Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
I utilize medications. That's 90% of what I do on my job.
Yeah, I feel like I'm not being unfair to say that in psychiatry, that's the funnel. That's where the funnel goes.
Right.
Yeah.
And there are a number of reasons for that. At most institutions, it's much more, the training is much more medicine-focused
right.
than therapy-focused. Reimbursement favors seeing multiple people for short visits to do medication rather than fewer people for longer visits for therapy. Therapy, it's easier to say you're doing a bad job in therapy, I guess, as opposed to if you're prescribing medications and someone doesn't respond well, it's like, well, I was at medication, I guess.
It's quantitative.
The failure isn't as personal. You know, it's like if you prescribe a medication, it doesn't go well. It's like, oh, as opposed to if you're a shitty therapist, that it's like, oh, you failed, you know, and it's a personal thing. My training in therapy isn't extensive. I haven't done anything beyond my residency training, but I was interested. I got into cognitive behavioral therapy, actually went to med school a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It made a lot of sense to me. You mentioned, is it internal family systems?
Internal family systems, yeah.
I really like the therapy component. You know, it's like I have no reservation about using medications when I think they're appropriate. I don't pitch them as a panacea. I've seen a lot of people come to me who are like, my last psychiatrist had me on this medication for 4 years, and I didn't think it was helping. And I told him that, and he never changed it. I'm like, well, then he wasn't doing his job. I don't advertise myself as a libertarian while seeing patients typically, but I really emphasize a personal autonomy issue, and it's worked well with a lot of people.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. You're going to be hearing this on July 1st, and we continue with my series of discussions from the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. My guest today is Jim Cunningham. Jim is a clinical psychiatrist. I have checked the records. Jim is the first psychiatrist to appear on School Sucks Podcast. I thought maybe we had a psychiatrist on the show in 2010, Bruce Levine, but turns out he's a psychologist. So here we are with our first psychiatrist. Some of you might be saying, Brett, I've been listening for a while. I've come to understand you're not a fan of psychiatry. This is true. And I thought it would be worthwhile. I'm actually happy with the result because this conversation took a very different form than what I originally expected. I was happy to take a calm and rational journey through the profession with somebody who's worked inside it for a long time. That is Jim's story. But Jim and I both, and you'll hear this in the show today as we kind of trade stories back and forth, have experience working in allegedly therapeutic environments. And through a lot of what we saw or what we did, we started asking ourselves important questions. So that will come through in the conversation today. Jim had been on my list of potential guests for a while. We first met in 2017. He is a School Sucks listener. I always knew there was a lot we could talk about together. He gave a presentation at the event called When Scientific Experts Determine Public Policy, What Could Go Wrong? You know how people say that kind of rhetorically? What could go wrong? Well, in the 20th century and into the 21st century, scientific experts, so-called, did wind up determining public policy in a variety of areas, and shit went wrong in many cases. So Jim's talk actually focused on the progressive era, the early 20th century, and the implementation of eugenics. So I thought that would actually make up a bulk of our conversation because many of the people who were advocating eugenic policies at that time in the United States were also deeply involved in the development of America's public schools. And I like to remind you guys sometimes that there are some problems with school. So we can do that through talking about the curriculum, the politics, the toxic environments, and another way we do it is through the history. So that, when we sat down in front of the microphones, that's what I pictured happening. What I got instead, I was much happier with. We do cover the eugenics topic a little bit, but we spend most of our time exploring the area where Jim has the most experience and expertise. And because of that, I feel like this hour is packed with far more information and insight than it would have been had we just talked about the history of the progressive movement with its ties to the development of public schooling in the early 20th century. It's a fast-paced show. Jim talks fast. That gets me thinking fast and talking fast. If you're doing me in your podcast player at 1.5, 1.6, hey, slow it down, okay? Do whatever you like. I'd really like you doing me at like 1.1. It doesn't screw up the music or the pace too much, but just adding that 10% speed increase does make me sound just a little bit smarter than I actually am. So 1.1 is good, and that's where if you're in a hurry, that's probably as high as you want to crank it up for this show. So there'll be more coming from the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest later this week. I loved these conversations. Give me more opportunities to do face-to-face interviews. It's always such a great experience. Actually, now I'm thinking, have I ever done a face-to-face interview that was just terrible? My first conversation with Thaddeus Russell in 2013, that got a little weird because I didn't understand what he was all about. And if you sit down and talk to him and you don't understand what he's all about, it can get a little weird. So I remember, like, that's one that comes to mind as being just a little uncomfortable, but it was uncomfortable in a way that I like. So I wouldn't even say that was a disaster. Just being able to get all of the additional signals from people, I just think it makes it a better experience as an interviewer. I also want to tell you, I'm just going to tease this. I'm launching another new monthly series for members only. The first episode is being recorded tonight. I'm not telling you anything about it, except my co-pilot, I think I'm actually his co-pilot, is Thomas Jechgai, who you might remember from the series we did last summer called Cinema Manufacturing about the film industry, and it even dug into some film analysis. Yeah, we're going back to that. If you want to support this show and get access to an ever-expanding library of members only. Yeah, I'm going to use that phrase, members only. Then snap, that's a pun, do a Google image search, members only jacket, into action, snap into action, and support this show. You can see all of our membership options at schoolsucksproject.com/AV if you want immediate access to all the premium content we produced over the last couple of years. You can go right to patreon.com/schoolsucks. I greatly appreciate your support. Also, you heard me mention this in the last monologue. If you want more information about the first School Sucks Virtual Summit coming later this summer, you can go to SSP University. You just spell it university for your convenience. Drop your email and we will send you updates about the details. Who's presenting at this thing? It is a spectacular list of presenters. And you'll also get access to deals for early enrollment once we pin down the dates. So sspuniversity.com. Use the access code SCHOOLSUCKS, one word, fill out the form, and you will hear from us with more soon. All right, everybody, here's my conversation with Jim Cunningham. I'm so glad we were able to do this. I'm so glad it turned out the way it did. I hope you enjoyed as well. Thanks for listening, and take care. Jim Cunningham, welcome to School Sucks.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think we first met each other face-to-face in Western Pennsylvania.
Yes.
In 2017.
Yes.
At our friend's farm as I was traveling across the country. We talked here last year,
mm-hmm.
and you've been recommended to be on this show
oh.
several times by several people.
Oh,
who pronounced your name wrong, I just learned.
It's very common.
You are a clinical psychiatrist.
Yes.
And you came today to give a presentation on eugenics and how eugenics relates to the progressive movement.
Right.
Now, this is a topic we talked about on my show before. What motivated you to come here and present
okay.
on that?
So, I guess, disclaimer, you know, early progressive movement, I don't think modern progressives are pro-eugenics as much as the
of
early
course,
ones.
Sure.
But as far as the why, there's a number of reasons why. One of them is that I often think back to this whenever I see someone commenting on Facebook or television or anywhere saying, you know, so we need, you know, science needs to determine our public policy for us.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that, you know, science should lead the way. And it's like, we've tried that before. And we ended up doing horrible things to
for a long time.
You know,
yeah.
We, in quotes, you know, the horrible things were done to people in the name of science has determined what is best for us. Another thing is being a psychiatrist in the greater libertarian community is a bit of a weird thing. Mm. Some people are fine with that. Some people have big reservations about that. Some people have declared my entire profession as an enemy of liberty. And so I kind of want to be open about the fact that I am not here to defend any dogmas on behalf of my profession.
Sure.
You know, it's like that if psychiatrists or mental health professionals have done something bad, by all, you know, it's like I'm not going to stand and say, everywhere, I think we should put Prozac in the water. I don't think we should put Prozac in the water. You know, have I done things I mentioned, you know, libertarian confessions yesterday? You know, it's like that. Have I, you know, signed a piece of paper that says that someone is not allowed to leave the hospital for 3 days? Yes, I've done mm-hmm. that. And that's one of the reasons I'm glad I'm out of inpatient medicine or inpatient psychiatry now, is that was a routine part of my job description and always felt icky. And it would create problems sometimes when I would try and move people along. I'm like, this person doesn't really need to be here. I'm infringing upon their civil liberties without even thinking there's a need for it. And like, but sending people home from the hospital involves quite a bit of paperwork.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, incentive to not do extra work. And so, you know, it's, whereas my quote unquote colleague on the unit, you know, so in Ohio, I can sign a paper and say that I think either you're a risk to yourself, you're a risk to someone else, that you are not adequately able to care for yourself in some way, shape, or form, or that you are engaging in behavior that is violating the risks of yourself or others, which is a pretty nebulous thing to say, and have you hold you against your will for 3 business days on a psychiatric unit. If we want to do more than 3 business days, we need to get a probate court judge involved, and they come down, and there's a lawyer for the patient, and there's a lawyer, actually, no, there's just a lawyer for the patient, and then and we pitch the case to the judge saying this person doesn't want to be here voluntarily, but we think they need to be for these compelling reasons. And if this is one of those kind of backhanded compliment things, it was intended as a compliment. The judge in the county I worked at the time said he knew as a libertarian, and if he got a request from me for this, he took it seriously, because he's like, you don't want to keep somebody here unless they really, really, really need to be here, which from a libertarian perspective can be argued.
How did that get out that you were a libertarian?
I don't remember. I remember being somewhat shocked when he mentioned it, and someone's like, no, you told him once. I'm like, I did? Oh, and my coworkers knew, but actually, I ended that job before I went to Porkfest for the first time.
Yeah, I was going to say, if I could venture a wild guess, when you started pursuing this as a career, you maybe had a different worldview?
I probably was always a proto-libertarian.
Sure.
That, you know, in high school, identified as a liberal, but I kind of had a, but you know, not a progressive modern liberal, more of I kind of glorified what I understood about hippies. And, you know, it's like, all right, government intrusion, anything bothered me.
Yeah, I think that's really dependent on when and where you're from.
Right.
Right. Because you could easily, like, if you see that as being, as young people often do, like against the establishment.
Right, right.
Ironically, considering your talk today, but
yeah, exactly. So, like, I was thought of as kind of hippie-esque liberal by many of my classmates. And so at one point, they were discussing having a walkout from school, and like, oh, this is a protest. You're going to like to do this, right? And it's like, you're having a walkout in because they didn't pass a levy for the school. Like, I have no interest in that whatsoever. That's like, yeah, no, I don't like the school. I was referring to school as state sponsored childcare, like in 10th, 11th grade, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
I was like, that's what I'm here for. That's the purpose. And yeah, I took some tests in one of our history or government courses, and it said I was a moderate. And I think it's because of the fiscal conservative, social liberal thing that it's like, we should pay for this. Like, no, and people should be free to do that. Yes. And then you average that all out, and it said I was a moderate. And people were like, oh, wow, Jim's a moderate.
Do you think that doing this work through the years and see, like, okay, so let's take that example that we opened the conversation with where you sign this piece of paper mm-hmm. to basically, you know, I mean, if people want to get aggressive with the language, mm-hmm. hold somebody captive for 3 days, right? Was it doing this kind of work that maybe helped move you down the path towards the philosophy, the full philosophy of liberty faster? Because it certainly was for me. Like, you know, I'm 20, when did I start doing that work? I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a med certified person. I was from residential to education by the time I was like 22. And I was the person doing the bad things.
Or the things,
I don't want to say the bad things. I was the person discovering that things I was doing were not always aligned with what was best for the person we were supposed to be treating or helping or whatever. And I also understand that what I was doing, I mean, I started to understand that this was a function of the state,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
And it wasn't even like I understood it on a political or philosophical level. It's like, we would do things and someone would come and say, no, Connecticut says we can't do that. Connecticut is a state, right?
Right.
Or Rhode Island says we can't do that. So we are operating this school in this way, often to the detriment of the kids there, at the behest of these states and their representatives that are sending us money. So that actually, that was part of, you know, my push
right.
down that path. So I don't know if it was similar for you. Already kind
always,
of
what about,
getting
like,
there.
I heard the word libertarian like shortly before starting medical school from some woman on AOL, when AOL was the full-fledged chat room everything.
Yep.
And I had the, what's that? You know, and she explained the simple version of it like, well, yeah. It's isn't that obvious? Leave people alone. And, you know, it's like, you know, and so gave a label to something that I didn't know was a valid choice. I'd always known, like, I didn't like, you know, it's like I voted for Ross Perot when I was, you know, when that was my first big presidential election because I didn't like those other things. And I kind of came at it from, you know, a lot of libertarians are like, oh, I came at it from economics or, Jeremy says he came at it from history. I kind of came at it more of an informal philosophical thought process. It's like, I don't like people messing with me and I probably shouldn't mess with them either. And
There's a name for that.
Yeah. And it kind of came at it, this is going to probably enrage a lot of people, but I came at from sort of a relativistic point of view. It's like people, I think, strawman relativism. It's like, oh, if you say you're for moral relativism and someone murders someone, you can't say that's wrong. It's like, I can say I don't like it and act on it. I don't need a quote-unquote objective ideology to validate that. You know, and that's what civilizations do. And I'd love to sit around and debate that around a campfire for hours at a time, but we don't have that what we're here for. But so, yeah, on my job, I would see people abuse, from my point of view, mm-hmm. the authority that had been, you know, vested in us by the state of Ohio. You know, so yeah, the one other psychiatrist on the inpatient unit I worked at would basically have the probate court judge come to say yes or no, they can be held for more than the 3 business days to protect her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had certain criteria. You know, it's like, do you have evidence to believe that this guy is an imminent risk to himself or others?
Right.
And people don't stick to that criteria. They say, well, he might. And it's like, well, yeah, might is not the threshold we're supposed to meet. You know,
yeah.
And it's like,
yeah.
And her attitude was, if some, you know, he might someday do something. And if he does, and they come looking to sue me, I want it written down that the judge said I had to let that person go.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, that's not the threshold we're supposed to be meeting. You know, it's kind of like when you see videos of police, I'm going to go ahead and say harassing someone who's carrying a gun in public. You know, it's like, we just want to make sure that you're okay. That's not the threshold, even with it operating within you, you know, your framework. That's not the threshold you're supposed to meet. You know, they haven't done anything. If it's an open carry state and they're not doing anything threatening, you've got no reason to bother this person and have them prove to you that they are not a threat.
Right.
You know, and it's like, but that's how they rationalize it on these videos that I've seen. And I haven't watched any in a good long time. But, you know, it's like you're not even playing by what are supposed to be your own rules. You're kind of taking it and bending it and, you know, mission creep-ish sorts of things. I saw people being held on cases that I didn't think were okay. I think there's a lot of overdiagnosis. You know, again, I'm happy to criticize my profession and colleagues. You know, semi-puritanical, culturally conservative, while maybe being very, you know, politically progressive people are like, well, you don't live the way they do at the little, you know, schoolhouse I grew up at, you know, and so therefore you're bipolar disorder. And so they're and start putting chemicals in people that I don't think are necessary.
Yeah. I mean, that was always my experience working in a therapeutic environment, right? Which had the educational component that I was a part of. It had an outdoor education and a residential and a clinical component. Mm. What seemed to be happening, and I saw this, you know, I think this is very easy to say in like a very, like an abstract way, but I saw like the kids internalizing that they were becoming these labels,
mm-hmm.
but they would say, I can't do that because I'm this.
Oh,
this
right.
is what I am.
Right.
You know, and
it's its own kind of identity politics in a way. It's like, I did this because I'm bipolar.
Well, that's exactly it. No, and that has been one of my biggest criticisms of using some kind of label that also has victimization and aggrievement attached to it as an explanation for all the problems that you have, because then maybe you never look at what those problems really are.
Right. Yeah,
like you're a victimized this in a cruel society against this thing.
Right.
Now, that even on the surface could be true, but you know, we're always seeking explanations that make the world, that make meaning and make the world make sense. And if that's sufficient, I mean, when I was 16, 17 years old, I didn't have like a super positive attitude about like really hitting the books and digging in and trying to figure things out. I wanted the right answer as fast as possible. So if somebody could have given me something, an explanation of the struggles that I was feeling that was so pacifying and they were so convincing about it, I would have played along.
Right.
You know, I certainly would have accepted that. And it's a shame to see that happening to kids now as young as 10 years old, at least. And those are the stories I know, maybe younger in some cases. So
yeah,
go ahead.
I know you've talked about working in that setting. And that's, I think, one of the worst examples of modern psychiatry is like the child and adolescent, when it overlaps with residential facilities and CPS and foster homes, which I've had minimal involvement with. It's just adult psychiatry. And I'm grateful for that because of what happens in those settings. But it's, in my training, I did a half a day a week for a year at a community mental health center for adolescents. And so was seeing a lot of these people, and they had a guardian. And so anytime we wanted to give them a medication, we had the guardian had to sign. And there was just a lot of cynicism and apathy, and it's like, and
burns you out fast.
Yeah. We were kind of going through the motions, and it's like, even if this medication is going to help you, this is a drop in the bucket compared to what your life is like. That's emphasis on even if.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing. Like, have you ever tried to change yourself?
Right.
And you look at the confluence of things that led you to the place where you say, I have problems. I have problems I'd like to solve. Mm-hmm. And, maybe sometimes in the New Age movement, there would be like a lot of panaceas, right? Do this one thing. Crystals or whatever.
Right.
But you think about what got you here and all the things that contributed to you getting to this place. Now, I've certainly things like figured out things that were more helpful than other things for me. But it's probably going to be an all-hands-on-deck approach to solving that problem, too, right? It's probably going to be – it's a complex mixture of things that get you out of the place.
Right.
It's a complex mixture of things that get you into that place.
Yeah, absolutely. Which I think has been a valid criticism of psychiatry is that – and sometimes people call it because individual-focused, which I think is a bit of a straw man. But it's like, we're dealing with one person and – ultimately, the problems are theirs, and that's what they're coming to me for. In an ideal, voluntary, they're coming to me, but their environment, I have no means of influencing other than by counseling them in some way, shape, or form about taking steps to change their environment.
Right.
But how much of their environment is under their control? And I've told people that it's like, I don't think that medication is going to do much for you in this because, it's like your environment is shitty. It's like, I've said this to people. It's like, I can't medicate you into not feeling bad about what's going on with, unless I put you under general anesthesia.
Yeah.
Which is not appropriate. I'm still happy to work with them in any way, shape, or form. And it's like, what can we do? What about your environment? Can you change? I've got a handful of people now that see me almost exclusively for therapy, which is great. Like if I had to do it all over again, this is kind of going back to what you mentioned before, that how have my attitudes changed since I've been in psychiatry? It's like, if I had to do it all over again, I might've gone psychology because I utilize medications. That's 90% of what I do on my job.
Yeah. Am I totally being like, I feel like I'm not being unfair to say that in psychiatry, like I saw a psychologist the last time I was like in any kind of therapy and there was never any mention of medication. And I feel like psychiatry, like, that's the funnel. That's where the funnel goes.
Right.
Yeah.
And there are a number of reasons for that. At most institutions, it's much more, the training is much more medicine focused than therapy focused. Reimbursement favors seeing multiple people for short visits to do medication rather than fewer people for longer visits for therapy. Therapy, it's easier to say you're doing a bad job in therapy, I guess, as opposed to if you're prescribing medications and someone doesn't respond well. It's like, well, I was at medication, I guess.
It's quantitative.
Like the failure isn't as personal. It's like if you prescribe a medication, it doesn't go well. It's like, oh, as opposed to if you're a shitty therapist that it's like, oh, you failed, and it's a personal thing. My training in therapy isn't extensive. I haven't done anything beyond my residency training, but I was interested. I got into cognitive behavioral therapy, actually went to med school a little bit. Mm-hmm. It made a lot of sense to me. You mentioned, is it internal family systems?
Internal family systems, yeah.
Stephanie.
Murphy.
Murphy, thank you.
Yeah.
Just emailed me an audiobook based on that, like literally like a week ago.
The Body Keeps the Score.
I was listening to on the way here.
And the guy who reads that is the same guy who reads Renegade History of the United States.
Is he?
He is the best audiobook reader ever. He is amazing. Better in Renegade than this book, but he's got a very nice voice. So you'll enjoy that, I think.
I have been. Yeah, I listened to it on the drive here, and I've got... It's like, I don't like that element, but I've got a lot of it. But I really like the therapy component. You know, it's like I have no reservation about using medications when I think they're appropriate. I don't pitch them as a panacea. I've seen a lot of people come to me who are like, my last psychiatrist had me on this medication for 4 years and I didn't think it was helping. And I told him that and he never changed it. I'm like, well, then he wasn't doing his job. You know, and it's like I put a lot of autonomy on them. Like I don't advertise myself as a libertarian while seeing patients typically, but I really emphasize a personal autonomy issue and it's worked well with a lot of people. I've had like a grandmother who has her 18-year-old grandson living in the house and she feels victimized by his just being, he's kind of exploitative. He's not abusing her or anything, but she feels kind of helpless and is like, you're allowed to kick him out whenever he crosses that threshold that you decide you're not put up with this anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that you are not obligated to keep him there while he treats you poorly because he's your grandson.
Right.
And it was, she had like a little light go on and it's like, and she kept him there, but she had that, I know I can terminate this if it gets bad enough that I can do it, which sometimes just having that perception of control changes things for people. Like people in Oregon, it's my understanding, who have terminal illness and are granted the, you know, you're allowed to take this lethal cocktail to end things if it gets bad enough. Most of them, it's my understanding, don't ever use it, but have greater quality of life for whatever remaining time they have, because it's like, if this gets too bad, I can end it. Feeling helpless and powerless isn't a fun sensation for any of us.
Sure, sure.
You know, and so she was able to get, and it's like, I can end this. If my, you know, he goes too far, I can get rid of, you know, and that helped her. But I tell people, it's like, yeah, if I'm, I also tell people, I want to put as little chemical in your body as I can get away with in order to get you the results that you want.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not here to put chemical in your body to make me feel better.
Do you feel like a lot of people come to you seeking that? Like, not I'm not saying like explicit drug-seeking behavior,
right,
but like they expect that that's going to be the solution?
Right, that there's a cultural attitude that this is the solution for my emotional problems.
That's commonplace. That's everywhere.
That I think is somewhat problematic. Back in the pre-Prozac era, primary care doctors didn't prescribe a lot of antidepressants because tricyclic antidepressants, if you take them in overdose, can kill you.
Yeah.
And so it was like, you need to see the specialist for this stuff. And then Prozac came along and all of a sudden it's like, oh, you can overdose on this and it's probably not going to kill you. And primary care doctors started prescribing more and more and more. They prescribe more in this country than psychiatrists do, mostly because there's more primary care doctors in this country than the psychiatrists.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets into, we're spinning off on tangent after tangent.
Wait, I don't even care if you answer one of my questions. I'm just happy to talk about this.
So have you ever seen commercials for Abilify?
Yes.
Okay, so Abilify was originally an antipsychotic. So it's for people with schizophrenia, and I think an indication for bipolar disorder too. Not bipolar too, but bipolar disorder as well. Then later it got an indication for depression to augment, you know, so it's like someone's on a medicine for depression. I think it's what the commercials say, you know, and you're on a medicine for depression and you're kind of better, but not all the way better, that you can get on this medication too. And it'll get you all the way better. Second generation antipsychotics. So things like Zyprexa, Risperdal, Abilify, there's been evidence that they do kind of augment antidepressants for quite some time, but now they got an indication for it. I'm completely convinced that that was to get primary care doctors prescribing it more.
Yeah.
Because primary care doctors don't like prescribing antipsychotics, typically. There are exceptions, you know, or mood stabilizers or manic meds. But it's like, oh, this is for depression. All of a sudden, it goes into a box that I'm used to working with. It's like, okay, this medicine's for depression. There's nothing different about the medication at all. But now it's in this toolkit that they're used to using. And I think the expectation was primary care doctors are going to prescribe this more. And so, therefore, more money goes to whatever company makes Abilify. I honestly don't know.
So from your inside opinion, is it really just these perverse incentives? Is it that coupled with obedience and conformity within a profession? I don't know if you ever heard on my show when we talked about, who was the physicist? Discipline Minds, that book. This physicist, I think his name was Schmidt, he wrote a book when he said, you know, a lot of training in the in science and medicine is really like finishing school for what people get in the lower levels of public education.
Okay.
Like they come out of those things so lockstep because those professions, sciences and medicine, require conformity. Like I even know people who've gone through something like nursing school and they say that they're just abused into, like, beaten down, that they can just be molded into whatever they need to be for that profession. So I don't know if it's a, like, you know, the way it's often explained is like these greedy doctors, you know, they're being taken on golf trips by pharmaceutical companies. First time ever I ever saw this, I was a teacher. I ran the specialized program. The year was 2003. Somebody said, go to this 4-star restaurant for a free presentation on maybe it was attention deficit disorder. And the person putting on the presentation at this dinner that was paid for and was beautiful and delicious was a pharmaceutical rep. And that was like where I kind of, and this was like right at the beginning of like my coast to coast radio days.
Okay.
My eyes were open to find something to be suspicious of, but nobody else seemed, one other person seemed affected by it or thought this was weird or thought this was kind of gross that we're supposed to be, this is professional development for us, but we're being told how maybe this drug would help somebody we know.
Right.
That was, yeah, that's how the presentation ran. So is it, I mean, from your inside opinion, is it a combination of those things, or do you see like a real specific cause of the overprescription from the doctor?
From the overprescription, I mean, it's an easy thing to do. It's like, and which I think is not exclusive to mental health. I've mentioned before, I haven't mentioned here that I trained in family medicine before I did psychiatry. So I graduated medical school in 1999, did 3 years at a rural family medicine program, and then went to a psychiatry program, which I was able to do 3 years of, was board certified in both for several years and practiced in both settings for several years before, mostly because of lifestyle issues after having children and whatnot, started doing exclusively psychiatry. You look at guidelines about treating people for viral upper respiratory illness, and you know, it's like, don't use antibiotics, and antibiotic prescriptions are rampant for those sorts of things. You know, you know, if the person comes in and says, I have a sinus infection, it's like, all right, I'll give you Augmentin, versus a person comes in and says, I think I have a cold. It's like, oh, you probably have something viral, go away. But they have the exact same symptoms in history, you know, and there's just a lot of, I want to keep the patients happy. And it ends up becoming this weird, perverse thing that sometimes the patient doesn't want that, but the physician assumes the patient's there for that. And so it reinforces that this is the proper thing to do. And then the next time the patient comes in and it does expect it. So it's this weird self-fulfilling problem.
It's also like a place where the knowledge disparity between service receiver and provider are so great that a lot of people, I would just imagine, like, fortunately I haven't had to spend a lot of time in any of these environments, people wouldn't be very good advocates for what they need. They would mostly quickly defer authority to the so-called expert.
Yes and no, and you know, because we're talking about people, and some people do one thing.
Sure, sure.
But you know, a lot of people come in for their antibiotic, and I've mentioned this. A lot of my job is being the gatekeeper for prescription medications, not just controlled substances, but prescription medications. I am the means by which people get these things, and so they come to me with the intent of getting them. You know, I had one patient when I was still in family medicine who came because she'd been feeling sick for a while, and she said outwardly that she wanted to find out if she needed an antibiotic or not, not to get it. And I like wanted to cry and hug her, you know, because that was not something that I was used to seeing. Same thing, but yeah, controlled substance even more so, that, you know, it's like that I cannot, you know, get Xanax easily. And so I, you know, may not tell the doctor I'm there for Xanax, but I will concoct a story with which to get Xanax. And I resent being assigned that job responsibility. Like, go ahead and make these things over the counter so that people can come to me because they want my, you know, they want a consultation about what is it that I can go and get over the counter is going to, you know, help me out, because I've tried this and I tried that and this didn't work and that didn't work. I would love it if that was my role, as opposed to people coming in and they've determined what they needed because they read it on the internet somewhere.
Right. Or saw a commercial.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which I'm happy to have conversations about those two commercials, or about what their friend did better on, or whatever. You know, it's I've had people say, I read about this, and like, you know what, that's a good idea. You know, there's this reflex thing amongst a lot of physicians about, you know, it's like, don't confuse your Google search with my medical degree. It's like, I don't know everything. You know, it's I've said, you know, my narcissism demands that I admit that I don't know everything.
Anytime I've talked to a doctor, like I had an issue a few years ago, they thought it was a thyroid thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I said, well, this is what I've been reading. And I was told, well, you shouldn't be going and looking things up online. I understand that maybe there's people out there mm-hmm. who shouldn't do that. But could you assume that maybe I have some critical thinking skills, like
right.
some putting puzzle pieces together skills, and I'm at least competent to come in here with like several things that I've found
right.
and we could have a conversation about it instead of you telling me not to look
right.
into things
that
for
is,
myself.
That it is a constructive thing to ask you, what did you read?
Yeah.
And here's why I think that is good or bad or otherwise versus no. You know, it's like you don't have a white coat or MDF your name. Yeah, like that is, yeah, a big problem, I think, in my profession. Now, full disclosure, I have told a few people who are especially anxious or borderline hypochondriacs.
Yes.
It's like, what are the side effects from this medicine? Look, and here's the one or two you need to look out for, because if it happens, something bad's going to happen, you need to get medical attention. This is just my standard talk about side effects and starting medication. And it's like, if you have something mild and it's not really problematic, keep taking it and see if it gets better as your body gets used to it. If you have something bad happen, stop it. You don't need my permission to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Just when starting something, if you've been on it for a while, you know, stopping something's cold turkey can not be great. But, you know, it's like, and I'll say that even. It's like, well, right now, you just started it. You don't need to back off gradually. Just stop it. I just ask that you call me and let me know so I know what happened and can talk to you about it and figure something out. Because, yeah, it's people. I don't want that Milgramian authority. I don't want that. You know, and it's like that keep taking this even though it makes you sick. That's not my job description. You know,
right,
it's
right.
Like that. Doctors have a bad reaction to. There's, you know, some people, it's like, well, I know my body, which gives us bristles, but it's like, but you do, you know, and if you're telling me I know my body and I need Percocet, that's a different conversation versus like something is wrong with me. I need help figuring it out. And people brush them off. A lot of physicians are horrible communicators. I've got a guy who
yep.
was sent to me because they think he was, you know, his physical symptoms, and I don't want to say too much, were all anxiety, and I talked to him, and he definitely had anxiety, but his physical symptom was independent of the anxiety. That when he was anxious, it was still there. When he was not anxious, it was still there. He had an enormous workup that hadn't found anything bad, and it's like, all right, this is not secondary to your anxiety. Yeah, you know, you've got this kind of non-specific symptom that you have anxiety about that I think is excessive, but the symptom itself is not from your anxiety. I don't think it's dangerous or bad. Modern medicine, I'll tell this to people all the time, is not great at identifying everything. Or we're pretty good at eliminating as possibilities things that will kill you if we actually do what we're supposed to do. Definitely there are people who have had symptoms and gone to see doctors and were dismissed and then later found out to have had bad stuff. I don't deny that that happens at all. But, you know, it's like this guy's been worked up from top to bottom. It's like, you've got nothing bad causing this. That is different from it being, you know, secondary to anxiety, and
which can just manifest in so many different
right. oh,
ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. And change, like, because I struggle with that, and it will manifest as one symptom, and you go and get it checked out, and everyone will be like, fine, get out of here, you know, like perfectly healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it will reappear as something else. It's very, yeah, so I can,
no.
I have sympathy for people who have that situation for sure. But no, I get what you're saying. And just to jump back to something you said a second ago about sure. not wanting that Milgram
oh, yeah.
authority, I'm wondering, to make a bit of a sharp transition here, if like in thinking about what you do,
mm-hmm.
that kind of extends into the warnings that you were providing today, because that's like playing, I don't know, playing God is kind of cliche and maybe hyperbolic, but on a whole nother level,
mm-hmm.
right? When we were talking about, you know, your first warning, which is what we've been talking about on your professional level, like science will solve these problems
mm-hmm.
kind of thinking,
right.
to like the most tragic scale I think it's ever happened on, which was in the early half of the 20th century. It was bad here,
mm-hmm.
but the way eugenics and euthanasia showed up in Central Europe was obviously worse. It was
right.
obviously
oh.
one of the worst things the world's ever seen. So that's the place to which this can go. But it seems like there is a lot of acceptance in culture,
mm-hmm.
in trying to solve physical and mental problems primarily, that science has all the answers and trust science.
And people have outsourced a tremendous amount of personal responsibility because of that. And there's some predation related to that outsourcing.
Right. You can go too far in either direction. You know, that someone expecting to have something explained to them is a reasonable thing. You know, it's like, shut up and listen to the experts is not a valid thing to say to somebody.
Right.
You know, it's maybe valid to say, you know, to a two-year-old, but it's like, listen, we need to put the swab in the back of your throat so we can test for strep, and whether you like it or not, we got to do that so we can find out if you have strep throat. With fairly intelligent adults, it's not a legitimate thing. You know, it's that we need to do this because we're trying to save the environment and you don't understand it, but trust the experts. It's like, no, who's going to explain this to me? And science is constantly changing what it's telling people. Yeah. You know, which some people then could overrate, like, well, it's a bunch of crap. And it's like, no, it's you know, we're finding out new stuff and things, you get more data and things change. You know, it's like when I was in medical school, beta blockers were contraindicated in people with heart failure. That, you know, these are medications that basically block one of the types of adrenaline receptors in your body. And so your heart pumps a little slower and not quite as vigorously. And superficially, it looks like that would be bad for heart failure. Your heart's already not pumping strong enough. By the time I finished medical school and was starting internship in 1999, they were the most strongly suggested medication for preventing mortality, so keeping people from dying from heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that things happen that we don't expect. You know, a lot of, I've talked to Stephanie Murphy about this too, that there's a lot of dogma that isn't evidence-based in medicine. You know, it's, we extrapolate from what we know and say, so based on what we know, we think this would work this way, and then we find out otherwise. And so recommendations change. Going with, you know, the modern science, I think, is a good idea, but I don't have any sort of divine right of science to determine things for people. You know, that I'll, you know, tell people that I think this is would be best for you in this case, but A, things, you know, people come back, I'm like, no, I felt terrible. I'm like, all right, I'm okay, let's try something else. Or if you don't want to try something else, we can wait a while. Let's figure something else out.
Do you think that there's also kind of like a dialectic that's happening that's unhelpful? Like, so think about vaccines, for example, right? So I've looked into this, but I mean, from it would be a long time before I would be comfortable taking a hard position on that issue publicly for thousands of people.
Right.
When I have very little at stake, I don't have kids. What I've learned is, like, vaccines do have certain elements that appear to be harmful, and the schedule is a little tight, you know, for, and it maybe it starts a little early, and maybe that's done for the sake of efficiency or to minimize costs. But if there is carelessness, like, we see a lot of things happening in medicine that aren't necessarily what's best for patients, but they've been accepted, right? So even if it's good to get vaccinated from certain historic illnesses, it's been tightened up, the vaccines aren't as clean, and they come too close together and they come too early. The dialectic with the medical profession is basically like, well, this is how we do it. You could be like one of the people who don't like it, but they're, you know, fucking crazy.
They're fringe. Yeah
exactly.
Like, I was thinking back to you talking about going to the event with the drug rep selling stuff and how everyone else is like, this is the standard of care, which is what you're measured by if malpractice comes up. You know, it's like, did you deviate from the standard of care? You know, and then that, did that deviation directly lead to damages? I think those are the four D's.
You know, so in the standard of care,
if you're practicing the standard of care and something bad happens, you're in the clear. You know, in the standard of care,
it's just a checklist, basically.
It's, you know, there's, I mean, it's like the way we do it. You know, and it's like, all right. And there are people who investigate some of these things, but then, you know, evidence-based medicine is something that there are people who emphasize, but...
Oh, of course.
You know, it's like anything is corruptible.
Anything
is prone to bias. And there's a strong, you know, it's... We're stamping out disease, and that's a good thing. How can you be opposed to that? And I'm not an expert on the components of vaccines, and that's probably one of the reasons I'm glad I'm outside of family medicines, is that that's now outside of my day-to-day practice. I mean, I am not... didn't have a lot of reservations about giving vaccines then, but I didn't, you know, this has been a criticism I've heard. It's like, these doctors don't really know. And it's like, you know what? Yeah, I haven't studied this stuff well. It's just that these guidelines are handed to me, you know, and the experts, medicine is very hierarchical. And, you know, it's like that we are in a position above the patients, and then whoever designs these guidelines in a position above us, and we're part of this machine, and this has been handed down to us. This is a good idea. That happens a lot. And, did you know everything that was in this? It's like, well, no, but everyone else is doing it, you know, and it's like everyone else jumped off this cliff.
Yeah. Okay. So that is like, I think people see it more like from the outside and maybe even in a kind of conspiratorial sense, they see it as more monolithic, like it has an agenda.
Okay.
You know, then we don't see, I feel like, and this is true with any controversy, it's like the rational middle voices are not the ones that you get to hear right. a lot from. But I mean, I was just using vaccines as an example of that scientific phenomena where it's like all in on this science in a very trustful and obedient way versus like, instead of understanding that, you know, this is evidence-based medicine, you know, it works for a great number of people, or many of these things work for a great number of people, you say, no, because of this, this, and this, I reject the whole thing.
Right.
Right? And it's all a scheme. And so I hope I've never taken that tone with anything medical on my show, including psychiatry, even though I feel like,
you know, said these dangerous SSRIs.
I have said that. Yes.
To which I will say they are certainly not risk-free. But poke at you for a minute. Because
yeah, go for it.
It reminds me of gun. It's like these dangerous guns or these dangerous. It's rhetorical. It's a rhetorical thing. You know, are they risk-free? No. No. Should they be used as prevalently as they are? No. Have I seen people have bad reactions? Yes. Have I seen people who attribute them as being life-changing? Yes. You know, and I don't think they should be sold as risk-free. But yeah, there are critics of them. And criticisms of them, I think, are completely valid. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about eugenics.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we ever fully dealt with why you wanted to present on this crowd.
So yeah, part of it was, like, I started talking about being a psychiatrist in the libertarian world. So part of it was, like, I set up that, you know, it's like, this profession, I am not a dogmatic, you know, protector of everything my profession does.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, I think I did mention that, you know, progressives like, we need science to determine public policy. It's like, no, that ends up doing bad things. Here's a great example.
And then we had plenty of examples from your current work, right. Which got us to here. Yeah.
And I like touching on things that don't seem to be common knowledge, which shocked me that they're not common knowledge.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure when I first found out this happened. I didn't take any history courses in college, but it probably came up in some sociology or psychology classes I took. I was a psych major in undergrad, so it probably came up somewhere in there. I might have picked it up in high school history. My high school history professor or teacher, you know, we learned about things like the Japanese internment camps and some other things that were, you know, kind of blotches on, you know, it wasn't all pro-American propaganda. So it may have been in there, but yeah, I've mentioned it to people and they're like, what? Like, oh yeah, no, it's like our scientists were like sending mail back and forth to German scientists and, you know, like they were, you know, crediting our scientists with really, you know, giving them some good ideas. And
I mean, let's all, of course, you know, the Nazis has a positive eugenics program as well. So
they did. I forget. I was watching some movie and they were like with some married couple with their newborn. It's like, oh, he's got 10 fingers and 10 toes, so now you get some, you know, Deutschmarks or something. It was, I wish I could remember what that movie was, but it was like, you've had an anatomically normal baby, so you are to be rewarded. But yeah, that's not what they're known for. And they did horrible, horrible, horrible things, which shouldn't need to be said, but.
Yeah, I haven't perfected, I'm not even close to perfecting the rhetorical usefulness of this whole eugenics topic. I mean, it's definitely something that I think we've talked about on my show, maybe back to like 2013. Gatto talks about it a lot.
Oh, really?
In his historical writing. Yeah. Oh, there's like sections of the underground history of the American education. I actually made videos about some of these sections too, like the Geneticist Manifesto, right? And how the Rockefellers were funding this. I'm very interested in what people were. And, you know, at one point, the Rockefeller Foundation was pursuing this almost full spectrum dominance of life in America, you know, on every single front that there was in eugenics and good breeding. Was a part of it. There's a tremendous amount of overlap in academia, in the progressive movement, between people who are designing education for the future, you know, and also trying to genetically modify the species for the good of the future, for the good of the nation, these kinds of things that you mentioned in your talk. And going at this, because I encounter a lot of skepticism with my stories about school and the background of school and some of the costs of sending children to government school for those children. And for society, too, you know, if people are interested in that, you know, beyond just the individual, I think people want to dismiss it.
Your message?
Yeah, I think so. I think it happens to all.
It's the standard of care.
There you go.
And you're deviating from that. So,
wow. Yeah.
And, you know, which is like, my parents spanked me and I turned out fine. And it's like,
yeah.
Well, clearly then that's a good means to apply universally. No, it's you're a deviant and, you know, you are guilty until proven otherwise. You know, it's most of the people they know went to public school. So it's like, how can you say this is bad? And it's like,
maybe their kids are there now.
Right.
Maybe the school is babysitting their kid while I'm trying to have this conversation with them.
Well, it's like, oh, that makes me feel bad. And it's like, and if it makes me feel bad, then you're wrong. And the window's shut. And
I think they still even it kind of the first back away, and it's understandable. And you know, I could always be working on providing people better answers, because especially if they never heard anything like this, it's not their responsibility to meet me where I am after doing all this research. You know, so I could probably have a better bridge to where they are,
right,
as far as, because it's like, what are you even talking about, school?
I liked something you said, and I don't remember how long ago it was, but you were talking, it may have been one of the shows you did with Brian and Stephanie, where you said you initially approached things as if people have this knowledge deficit, and if I present them with the knowledge, then they'll come right around, and it didn't work. And
so I started in the conspiracy world.
Right.
You probably heard me talk about this, right? So I remember it was like, I don't know, like the fifth anniversary of, let's say, I won't attach like various conspiracy theories to your real name that you're using on the show. So let's just say it was a milestone anniversary of an event that everybody had experienced. And I said, do you know this, and this about this event? As if that was like, and I actually know, I went into it thinking that other people had the same suspicions I did.
Okay.
But I didn't even actually generate these suspicions myself. I got them from like, you know, some conspiracy website or radio show or something. And I just thought, if I go right at these people, like, it must have been shocking.
Right.
They must have wanted to have me institutionalized when they are. And this was a long time ago. The internet was a lot different back then. But yeah, I used to demand, if I provide information, right, if I fill that knowledge deficit that you're talking about, we have to walk away from this conversation agreeing.
Right.
I filled your deficit.
Right.
Never happened. I remember arguing with my uncle, who was very liberal. I would just relentlessly attack him for hours, and then he would go, okay, you're right, okay. And it wasn't even like he was being sarcastic. He'd go, you know, you're probably right, I don't know. And then, you know, he would kind of reset.
Right.
By the next time I saw him. But yeah, I mean, that was how I started, sure.
You were talking about that this is the way you started, and you realized that, yeah, that doesn't work. That as a physician, yeah, it's like, all right, here, this is what you need to do in order to, you know, not have a heart attack in your 50s. You know, it's like, you know, and now I've told them what they do and need to do, and then they don't do it. Well, that's their fault. What is wrong with them? But yeah, it's like, if you actually want to produce or catalyze change of some sort, yeah, meeting them where they are, as you put it, you got to start there.
So where they are, right, just to talk about that, the rhetorical usefulness of the eugenics topic, do you believe in the Nazis? Most people say yes, right? I would think everyone would say yes. Do you believe in what they did? I mean, I'm hoping most people would say yes.
That actually happened?
Okay, that I'd be talking to. Do you understand? This is actually where it starts to get tough, right? Because when you ask people to try and understand the internal logic of something, like, why did this happen? To get people beyond, oh, because they were evil.
Right.
The dichotomy.
Yeah, it's just that easy. It's like, they were evil, we were not.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like Captain America punched Hitler and hooray.
But I really, if somebody was at that level, that's probably, I also understand, like, you know, if I was a doctor in an emergency room after some kind of boat disaster, I'm not going to spend hours on the guy with no head.
Right.
You know, I'm gonna look for the people that are easier to help than that. So, I would want, like, a prerequisite for taking the conversation further, I would think, would be somebody having some level of curiosity about, like, yeah, why? Why would such a horrible thing happen? How could so many people participate in that? Either whether they were the people doing it or the people supporting it.
Or just the bystanders.
As a nation. And I'd say, well, this was the science, right? There were all kinds of other like philosophical and cultural and economic problems happening. But this was the science that they were pursuing, you know? And that science came from here, which is takes us across the ocean to here. And these people were also, I mean, it is kind of, again, that playing God thing and that hubris that I think it happens on multiple levels, right? And the less checked it is, the more out of hand it gets. So you can see it in your profession with the person sharing a wing with you in a hospital, right? Somebody who does the same job, but from a different point of view.
Right. I will freely admit the hubris to knowledge ratio within psychiatry is way on the positive side.
Right.
You know, that patients will ask me, it's like, so how does this medicine work? And I'm like, I'm going to flat out tell you, we don't know. Which some then anti-psychiatry people will say, they don't even know how these medications work. And I'm like, no, we don't. And at the same time, if you look up the package insert for any anticonvulsant and your epileptic medication, it'll say right there, we don't know how this works.
Right.
You know, it's like the brain is wicked complex.
Right.
You know, and so, yeah, we are way, way behind. You know, it's like we're still finding out things about cardiology and the heart's a pump. You know, and so it's a neat pump and it does a really good job and we can't design one from scratch, you know, that'll work. Or the people that had mechanical ones like begged for death is my understanding. But you know, it's like, yeah, the brain leaves the heart in its dust complication wise. So yeah, we don't know. And so I end up going on a really empiric thing. You know, it's like if you're doing better, that's what matters. If you're doing worse, that matters when you do something. But yeah, we don't know. Which some physicians and I've admitted, it's like there's probably some patients who want to come in here and have me, you know, put on a white coat and stand behind a lectern and say, listen, this is going to correct your serotonin balance and it'll make you better. You know, and science has proven this, now go take it. And I'm probably sabotaging some potential for a placebo response in some people, which is like 50% of what antidepressants do is placebo response. That's science. But my integrity demands that I not do that.
Right.
You know, it's not just serotonin levels, and that is science. We know that. You know, it's like if someone starts taking an SSRI and we measure, which they've done with micropipette studies or some sort that I don't understand, you know, and actually measured intrasynaptic serotonin, it goes up immediately because you start blocking the reuptake transporters. By the time, you know, antidepressant effect kicks in 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks down the road, when they measured them, they're back down to normal again.
Mm-hmm.
Something is happening, you know, that your body is, compensating for this, and that compensation it might be doing something, but it's not, it's like, oh, your serotonin levels are low. It's not, no, it's not that. The chair of the department I did my residency training at did serotonin depletion studies. So people who had a history of depression were taking an SSRI and felt better. They would come up with this amino acid cocktail that basically had everything except for tryptophan in it. Because serotonin is basically modified, it's like 5-hydroxytryptophan, if I remember correctly. And so you would take this amino acid cocktail, and your body doesn't like free amino acids floating around. Because some of them are biologically active compounds, like glutamate is a neurotransmitter in your brain, and it's amino acid. So your body doesn't want these amino acids floating around, so it starts making protein with them right away. But it needs tryptophan, big protein. And so it like cannibalizes its own tryptophan stores. And these people would start crying.
What?
They'd sit there, they would drink this amino or eat and drink this amino acid cocktail, and they start crying or reverting back to whatever they were like before they were on the antidepressant medication. And then you give them like a hamburger or some other balanced amino acid, you know, protein source so their body can get everything, and it goes away. It was, he had like videos of these people doing this, and it was just the most amazing thing. We don't know what's going on. And I happily admit that. Is serotonin somehow involved with depression? I'm willing to say somehow involved. Is dopamine somehow involved with schizophrenia? I'm willing to say somehow involved. You know, if we give people a lot of amphetamine, which jumps up your dopamine receptor, your dopamine levels, you start hallucinating and getting paranoid. You block dopamine receptors too much, people start looking like they have Parkinson's disease. The, you know, dopamine hypothesis of schizophrenia goes back decades, and it's not just that simple. If it was just that simple, we could fix it. But it's somehow involved.
So as you talk about trying to avoid hubris, right? To scale way up, to zoom way out, do you see the possibility? Because I've seen a lot of developments. You know, I've worked in and around the schools over the last 15 or so years. Do you see the possibility with things getting this out of hand again, with this willingness to play God? I almost think the answer is no, because I think the knowledge disparity between the public and between the scientists trying to scientifically manage or engineer the population in the future was so much greater before.
Okay.
I think there's, even if most people are just as ignorant as they were in the 30s or the 40s on some of these subjects, I think the advocates for those people are making much more noise when there was no way for that to happen 70, 80 years ago.
Right.
So, or like when a lot of these sterilizations were taking place, or mercy killings, or, you know, any of the things that you talked about in your presentation today. Given your knowledge of the past, given the knowledge of your current industry, factoring in my consideration about a lot of the concerning things I've seen as far as over-prescription, over-diagnosis, especially for like typical boy behavior in elementary school, these kinds of things.
Absolutely.
Do you see this? I don't want to say, do you ever see it getting as bad as like sterilizing people in the 1920s in the United States? But do you see a turn happening away from this, like a public awakening? Instead of just being like, I conform to whatever the doctor says, I will put in my mouth whatever pills are handed to me on the one hand, to the all medicine is bullshit, doctors are conspiring to kill you, on the other hand, with everything from vaccines to prescription medication, have you already started to see this happen? An emergence of a more healthy, like, middle ground of skepticism and understanding of this?
I've seen some of that. I don't know if I can say it's a trend or not, but...
Yeah.
I'll, you know, say, I think this medication might be a good thing for you to take. And then they're like, why that one?
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm thrilled to death to have that conversation. You know, it's like, I'll tell you why that one. But then I freely admit to people, and again, this is kind of unique to what I do. It's like, this is trial and error. I admit that. You know, it's like that I pick something kind of, you know, based on, you know, experience and some preference about this, that or the other. And I've seen, you know, this medication do well for people with the complaints similar to your own. But yeah, I've seen people, it's like expressing appropriate curiosity.
I've definitely seen a DIY culture emerge over the last 10 or 15 years, and that's good. And I do understand, as somebody who's mildly hypochondriac, that it isn't always the best thing and to go and ask Google what your symptoms mean, because it seems like most of what it will tell you are the worst possible things that it could be. And it also really narrows down the complexity of whatever you might be dealing with.
Right.
You know? And it could be a confluence of things that...
But someone looked at that, and apparently if you do a Google search for your symptoms, the right diagnosis will be in there somewhere. The keywords are right in there somewhere amidst, you know, cancer. It's like and everything else that you don't actually have, you know, so it's like eliminating the, you know, false positives is the problem with the searching for your symptoms. Not that it won't, it'll get the right positive, but it's in a mess of false positives.
Yeah, it's not terribly elucidating to put in your symptoms in a fair amount of detail and see that there's like 72 million search results.
Yeah.
So, I'm happy to see that. And I'm not saying that people need to go out completely on their own, like they would build their own fire pit or their own bar, their own, you know, like go to Home Depot kind of project with your health, but that people would become more active participants. I do see a general trend towards, it's hard to say if it's everybody, but even if it's just a vanguard of people doing that, I think that's really good. And I hope they report positive findings, and I hope that becomes more perfected and refined as time goes on. So people can feel more empowered in this area, whether it's dealing with their children, having problems in school, and being told things, as both my brothers with young children were told. And like anecdotal, sure, but that 2 out of 2 siblings, and I think something like 3 out of 4 nieces and nephews, there was a suggestion that they go on drugs. One currently is. I'd like to see people be more active in that. Also, the nieces and nephews of a man who's been kind of like warning against this stuff for 10 years, and their parents know that. But while this goes around the world, you know, it doesn't always get into the houses of the people closest to you. I think we all can identify with that as far as like trying to share our ideas go. But I see things moving in a positive direction with this, slowly but hopefully.
It's I'll join on the hopefully. Absolutely. Yeah, when that many people are, you know, it's like maybe they'd be on the medication. It's like when that advice becomes that common, it's time to step back and go, wait a minute. This isn't like an entire family having strep throat that lives in the same household. It's like, oh, yeah. All right, that happens. What is going on that is leading to this? And I think part of it is, you know, that if all you've got is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail.
Yeah.
That happens. You know, we kind of mentioned about what leads to, you know, what are all of the influences that lead to physicians prescribing more often than not, or prescribing inappropriately. And because there are arguments from both sides, you know, there are people who are like, ADHD is underdiagnosed and that needs to be diagnosed more often. And then there are people who are like, it's overdiagnosed. And it's no one saying maybe it should be diagnosed appropriately. Like no one's saying that's, you know, it's like there are people who do better on stimulants. And first of all, almost everyone does better on stimulants. They're performance enhancers. You know, mm-hmm. So people are like, oh, look, they're doing better on this. That means that he has the condition. It's like, no.
Yeah,
stimulants are performance enhancers.
And this is like the growing pains right now of what I think is progress. Like, so you have two positions on something, like two clinical positions mm-hmm. on something like ADHD or yeah. ADD. The two clinical positions kind of spill out into the public right. for debate.
Right.
And so then you wind up with these two camps that, because of the current communications technology, push further and further away from each mm-hmm. other while they're walls are built taller and taller, right? So then as that happens, it almost becomes, again, like that good and evil kind of mm-hmm. thing on a lot of these issues, vaccines probably being one that's out in front of right. all the others right yeah. now, where there's lots and lots of enemy imagery for the mm-hmm. people on the other side of the issue. And, you know, sometimes I look at this and I go, ah, shit, this whole world's falling apart. Look at these people fight with each other. But, I mean, this is maybe the beginning of a kind of awakening of people trying to be more self-assertive and responsible and in control of these kinds of decisions, right? We're at least seeing that there's the identification of people's need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
People want free, even if they wouldn't use these words, people want freedom in that area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody likes to feel like their life or their child's life is in somebody else's hands. So I think that even though it's ugly now, like mm-hmm. so many things online are and in the world of ideas are, I'm hopeful, and we share hope,
mm-hmm.
that we're maybe watching baby steps towards an awakening in this area and people being able to take more control and ultimately gain more freedom.
Yeah, I want to be a consultant. Physicians as a group, on average, there's always exceptions, you know, are just authoritarian nut jobs. They're benevolent, sort of, authoritarian nut jobs. But, you know, it's like they, you know, do this whole know what's best for you. And if you don't like it, then you're part of the problem thing. Kind of what we said about the knowledge deficit thing earlier, that happens a lot there. But I don't like that. You know, it's like I don't want to be, you know, authoritarianism just makes, you know, gives me the creeps regardless of where it comes up. This is not your car. You know, it's like you take your car and it's like, we need to replace this. You should have some skepticism about that.
Mm-hmm.
And people do. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, well, wait a minute. I'm going to go get a second opinion about this. You know, and people have come to me and said that their regular doctor had a fit when they said they were going to get a second opinion. It's like, that's probably a bad sign. I am not perfect. You know, it's like, if you go get a second opinion and it works out better for you and my interest is your well-being, then good. If they disagree with me and I don't have a God complex, then I'm not threatened by that.
Right.
There was, I remember seeing somewhere in college a little thing taped to a professor's door that said something along the lines of, the students coming here are not coming here to worship what we're teaching them. They're coming here to question it and challenge it, which is probably an attitude that is not common enough.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And, you know, as I'm probably preaching to the choir, you know, and a degree of that should be element, it should be present in medicine too. You know, it's like, why am I taking this? There's certainly cultural components to that. My ex-wife had a family member who, for whatever reason, they were in the Middle East and took their kid in to see somebody. I don't even know what they were for, maybe an ear infection. They gave him a, here, mix this, you know, there's this powder in this bottle, mix it up and give it to your kid. Well, what is it? And outrage resulted that you don't challenge the aristocratic physician
right.
sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are definitely elements of that in American medical culture too.
Well, we had that discussion on multiple levels today.
Yeah.
And I appreciate, actually, it was different than what I expected, but we spent most of it where you have the most experience and expertise, right? Like on the level of your profession.
Right, right.
Also, as we've done before, talking about like where this general kind of mindset can eventually go.
Right.
You know, and understanding that was very useful too. And it seemed like a lot of people got value out of your presentation, which was long, but most of it
was actually Q&A after the fact around the subject of IQ. So the next time we do a show, I would, if you'd be comfortable, I'd like to talk to you about that.
If you give me time to read up on IQ.
Absolutely. Okay. I'll read up on it, too.
My area of expertise, but by all means, yeah.
Yeah, because it seemed like the first like three, a bunch of questions that you got afterwards, or a bunch of the discussion afterwards were IQ-centric, yeah.
And IQ testing has definitely been used, has been weaponized. I'll go ahead and say that.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's where I'm at with it, too. So, Jim, thank you so much. I'm glad we finally get to do this.
Yeah.
This was an awesome discussion.
Thank you for having me. I'm really glad we did this. I enjoyed it.
There's one old man, spends his life growing flowers, caring for the bees. Power to the bees. There's one old lady, spent her days making wine. The wine tasted fine. Power to the vine. Power to the boys that played rock and roll. I made my life so sweet. And to the girls I knew before, those I've yet to meet. Power to all our friends. To the music that never ends. To the people we want to be. Baby, power to you and me. There's one strong man plowing in the valley. He's living off the land. Power to the land. There's some young girl laying down in Monte Carlo, laying in the sun. Power to the sun.